Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Chicago is strong. This is our home. This is a city that we built with our blood, sweat, and tears. This is a city that we must protect so it can provide for us. We know it's not perfect, but if it gets destroyed, we are all left to pick up the pieces. In this city, we care for each other. We've seen that over and over again. This is a time for us to unite. We have to turn our pain into purpose in order to get through this moment together and do the work needed to unite our city and move us forward in a way that is more equitable, inclusive, and just.
Want to know, did they hit the meat cooler? Did they take
I'm going to go down and check now. As of right now, what we know they hit is they basically, the majority of our liquor is gone. All of our point of sales, our computer system has all been vandalized. So even if we wanted to, we can't open. Our phones are ripped off the wall. We're not able to conduct business right now because of what happened, even if we wanted.
That's fine. 179 North Michigan, white. 139 North Michigan.
You're sitting there watching television in your house with the National Guard coming to Chicago, the city shutting down for another day of riots just as it was about to open for COVID-19. The city is in trouble and hurting. You are hurting. Chicago's hurting. Joining me as always is Jeff Carlin, my buddy and executive producer of The Rokan Show. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, writing an extra couple this week, member of its editorial board. And you're watching your city having been destroyed. The businesses in the central business district smashed. Versace, Gucci, Brandeis, places of civility and high civilization, smashed and ravaged or savaged by the mob. That's where we are. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Before we get into our interview with our guest, Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus of the University of Chicago, who has a great, great piece on Obamagate and what it means and why it's important. I know you're not thinking about politics, or maybe you are, because isn't the fist, the clenched fist, smashing a window or beating up a cop or dragging a police officer on the ground on Michigan Avenue, isn't that politics too? Just 2 weeks ago, we had people standing up in State House in Michigan. They had guns in their hands. They called themselves Second Amendment patriots. They were trying to open the city so they could get back to work after COVID-19, and they were opposing and protesting the shutdown. No businesses were destroyed. Nobody was burned. There weren't any businesses burned, and yet media called them Nazis, and Pritzker even jumped on it, and because somebody had a Nazi flag, tried to spread it and paint them all as Nazis. And now what I'm seeing is an effort by many to not acknowledge that Antifa or hard left, whatever you want to call it, was part of this and a central part of this. This was organized across the country. Yeah. This happened in major cities.
To assign a political stance to Antifa is foolish. Antifa, they're not a left leaning group that says, "Hey, we want the government to take care of anybody." They don't want any, but they are the new age anarchists. They don't want any government. So to make this a left versus right thing, that's my point. My point is that these groups, the politics has nothing to do with what was happening here last night in the city of Chicago. Nothing to do with it.
I would say it has everything to do with it, respectfully.
Yeah.
When you see a news anchor standing in front of a burning building and saying there's nothing to see here, you know, this is not a riot. Like saying that this is just a protest. This is not a riot while people are going inside and stealing cash registers. That suggests to me that people's analysis has been unhinged.
Yeah, but John, right. you and I have played out that story before, that there's absolutely media, people in media have agenda, and the agenda takes front seat to reporting. But that's not what was in the minds of people. I mean, here's what I saw, and I watched this, and I listened to the scanners, and this started with people who are just like the people with guns in Michigan and the state capitol, protesting something they thought that was wrong. But then it was co-opted by groups like Antifa, groups like gangbangers in the city who saw an opportunity. Yes. And you saw it transition from being what America's about to what we're not about. And to let hate take over. And that's what I want to get to the root of. And the mayor addressed that there was this idea that hate, you cannot let hate win the day. And that's what we're seeing from groups on from Antifa to gangbangers to, you know, the Proud Boys. If all those groups get their power and their motivation from hate. And once the dust settles, that's all we're left is the recourse and the disaster left by hate. And that's what terrifies me.
I agree that we've legitimized hate and called it useful for political, you know, if it's useful for one side of the political aisle, then it's useful for the other, and criminal elements in between.
All the problems that are coming to the surface, all the things that we're dealing with, all the reasons people are rioting and looting and protesting, all the things that have pushed people into those situations or those beliefs that what they're doing is great for them or great for whatever, those things are all hallmarks of the collapse of a great society. And I don't see I don't see a turn back on this. I don't see a way we say, well, we're going to put in some policies, we're going to change some things, and it's going to be all hunky dory. I think we're beyond the fold here on this. And I really, truly dread and have anxiety over what comes next.
I'm a little bit more optimistic in that I think that the common sense of the American people will not rise up like in anger or anything, but will show itself because the common sense of the American people is that most of us saw that video of Mr. Floyd being choked by Derek Chauvin, the police officer, and everybody, black, white, brown, whatever gender, whatever, you know, whatever you want to say, all human beings were disgusted by it. And then came the riots and the opportunity. But don't call it protest. It's not protest. And remember that in the next few minutes, you're going to hear Charles Lipson talk about other institutions that have worked very hard to destroy their own credibility. The intelligence agencies, the FBI, Washington bureaucracy, working in concert, thinking that they think they know what's best, better than the American people. You see these riots? I want you to think about what Charlie Lipson's about to tell you. Remember, there's one document that will be the life preserver. It's the Constitution of the United States. And the understanding that when they wrote it, our founders, that they understood that man is kind of crappy and corrupt and venal. Yeah. And they did not look to politicians to find virtue any more than, you know, I mean, like little children might look to politics for virtue, just like some people might believe in unicorns and hunt for like the purple unicorn that can fly. But there is no purple unicorn that can fly. And only children or fools believe that. Think in terms of the founders thought of reality. They understood human nature. They understood how venal and corrupt we could be. They knew that we could break off into factions, as they call them. We call them parties now, or tribes. I would listen to Charlie Lipson and think about it. Well, we have Charles Lipson here, and he's written, I think, a very, not only fascinating as all his pieces are, but a tremendously important piece of journalism and commentary. What the Obamagate scandals mean and why they matter. And I wanted to talk to him because he's writing as a historian, as a political scientist, not like some of these morons on cable. And they're on the right and the left, where they yap like dogs and give their party talking points. This is a serious piece because it's a serious issue. We're in a state now where the New York Times and the Washington Post have won Pulitzer Prizes for Russiagate, and Russiagate was a fraud. And at the same time, we have tens of millions, 40 million people out of work, tens of millions of jobs that won't come back ever. And all this and what's going on in Minneapolis, we have stress on our republic, serious stress. But I don't know what greater stress there can be than half the country wanting to use the deep state or the federal powers to destroy their enemy, and half the country not caring, as long as the victor, what is it? To the victor belongs the spoils. So you can use the federal government to destroy your enemies, and use the spy agencies to destroy your enemies. All this is going to rip our country apart, whether you know it or not, or whether you want to believe it or not. And Charles Lipson, why the Obamagate scandals mean, what the Obamagate scandal means, and why they matter. Why do they matter, Charles?
Well, the reason I wrote the article is that we were getting such a flood of details about the Flynn, the spying on him, and we were getting a lot of information about fraudulent FISA applications on Carter Page, and what about the spying on George Papadopoulos. It was becoming hard to understand what all of this was about and what it meant. And so what I wanted to do was clarify the main themes. And the way I see it is that Obamagate is really one huge scandal made up of three component parts. They're kind of, if you will, three scandals that make up this one bigger scandal. And the first has gotten almost no public attention because, as you say, the media was running away looking at something else. And that is that almost every thing we do electronically, text messages, emails, phone calls, everything else, is scooped up by the National Security Agency. And that agency has this huge database. The database includes what's called metadata. So for this podcast, it would be that Charles Lipson, John Cass, and Jeff Carlin are talking with each other, and they talk with each other for 30 minutes or 40 minutes, and they were in the following locations and so forth. you can look at that data and you can begin to figure out who John and Jeff and Charles and so forth are also connected with, and you can put them together into these networks and you can learn a lot about them. It turns out that the FBI allowed outside contractors, not even government agents, not even Bureau special agents or something, allowed outside contractors to come in and illegally search, just troll through this huge database.
Without a search warrant, without
That's right.
warrants.
Exactly. And finally, the head of the National Security Agency, who didn't know about this, his name was Admiral Mike Rogers. He found out about it and immediately stopped it. He went to the head of the FISA court, the secret courts that give these warrants and so forth, and reported it. And they have just ripped a new hole in Comey's FBI about it. So that's the first scandal. And what makes that scandal important is that it's arguably the largest violation of our basic constitutional protections against illegal search and seizure in American history. Now, the second scandal, which is well known, but was denied by the Democrats for a long time, is that there was spying on the Trump campaign and presidential transition. And that spying mostly took place by using fraudulent warrants to the FISA court, the secret foreign intelligence court. And to get those warrants, they had to claim that people who they knew were not foreign agents were actually agents of foreign powers. They had to say that people like George Papadopoulos was a foreign agent and Carter Page was a foreign agent. In Page's case, he actually, whenever he would meet with the Russians and so forth, he would come back to the FBI and CIA and debrief. He would tell them what he was doing. He was in no way a foreign agent, but they had to pretend that he was. And then they used this Steele dossier to strengthen their case and go after all the Trump campaign. So that's scandal number two.
Wait, in your story, yep. Even though they used that dossier,
yep.
Andrew McCabe testified that warrants would not have been issued without the Steele dossier, yet the FBI and DOJ never told the FISA court that it was unverified. And never
That's right.
said.
And in fact, they told the FISA court something completely opposite.
They lied.
Steele. Right. To get the information in this gossipy document, unverified and so forth, had himself a source, a subsource. And they went to the subsource finally when they were trying to renew, not before they got the first warrant, but when they were trying to renew it, the FBI went to the subsource and said, say, is any of this stuff true? And he said, no, it's all just gossip. There's no verification and so forth. The FBI and the Department of Justice went in their reapplication, the application to renew, said, oh, we talked to the subsource. He was so truthful. Not saying he was truthful to undermine what we said, but implying that he was actually verifying the Steele representations when he was saying quite the opposite. So
lying by omission. Right.
Oh, yeah. This was just outright fraud. So it's important to understand, though, going beyond that, what does this second scandal mean? It directly attacks two pillars of our constitutional democracy. The first is that elections should be free and fair, not corrupted by the party in power. Obviously, the party in power can do a lot of things. The president can fly in on Air Force One and he has a bully pulpit and so forth. You can't corrupt the election. And the second is that law enforcement and intelligence agencies, very powerful agencies, should never be used as partisan instruments. They can make mistakes. They can be tasked to do certain things by the president and so forth. But they can't become partisan instruments and be used in a campaign. And that's what they were. So that's a huge scandal. Now, the third scandal is that once Trump was about to come into office, the people who were engaged in this spying needed to cover it up. They wanted to continue it into the new administration. And then and they wanted to impede Trump's presidency, which they did with all of these investigations about Russia collusion. But the important thing to understand there is that by the time Trump was inaugurated, they already knew, and certainly very shortly into his administration, they knew that although Russia had intervened or tried to intervene in the election, it hadn't had much of an effect. It was kind of minor. It was pernicious, but it was minor. That there had been no cooperation with the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign hadn't done anything to collude with them. They had reached out to the Russians and they had done some other things, but they hadn't really done very much. So if and in fact, all the people who were supposed to be part of this collusion, when they were interviewed behind closed doors by the House Intelligence Committee, and they were put under oath, and they were asked, all of these people, the Susan Rices and the James Clappers and John Brennan, all of these people were asked under oath, do you have any evidence at all that there was collusion, cooperation, coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians? They all said, we have no evidence at all. Then they went right outside the room and said exactly the opposite and went further. They said, Trump is a traitor. Trump is a Putin agent. He's Putin's puppet. They said all these things when they were testifying under oath that that was not true. Now, why does that matter beyond lying? Because the peaceful transfer of power to a new administration, especially when that administration is from another party, is a hallmark of a stable democracy. Much as the Obama administration hated to see Hillary Clinton lose, the Obama administration was obligated to transfer power seamlessly to Donald Trump and not to try it by illicit means to undermine him. There's a loyal opposition. You can oppose his policies and so forth. But what they did was, on the surface, they seemed to transfer power seamlessly to Trump. But underneath the surface, they erected every obstacle they could, some of which they knew were illegitimate. There was no evidence for them. So this is yet another major scandal. So I'm saying there were three scandals: the NSA database scandal, the spying on the Trump campaign in transition, and then continuing the spying, trying to cover it up, charging Trump was not a legitimate president, and then trying to impede his presidency with major investigations based on charges they already knew to be groundless. So these are really major scandals, in my opinion.
You're describing a President Obama who came to Chicago in the 80s, understood who Harold Washington was, and he probably, I would assume, since he and David Axelrod was working at the Tribune, understood it, and then for Washington. In a sense, it's like the opposition to Harold Washington in the Council Wars. So is, in a way, I mean, for those of you old enough to remember, is Barack Obama the Eddie Burke and Eddie Verdolia of the modern age, but protected by the Washington Post and the New York Times, whose editor, at least on the Times side, Dean Baquet, I worked with and understands completely at the Tribune. I understands completely about what happened in council wars with Verdoliak and so forth. Is this what they did? It seems like exactly that.
Well, it looks pretty bad to me. And if we're talking about bad things that happened in Chicago, why don't you talk a little bit about the Red Squad and what they did in terms of illicit spying, because that, too, has a similarity to what happened here.
Red Squad, Jeremiah Joyce was a Mensa, a copper who was a Mensa member. Brilliant man, one of the smartest people in Chicago politics. He was on the Red Squad.
Well, tell people what the Red Squad was and what it did.
They basically infiltrated communist and left groups to topple them and discredit them.
Well, it's one thing to do that and to do it if you have a warrant and, you know, if you're doing it legitimately. But when you use all the powers of law enforcement and the foreign intelligence gathering against a political opponent, that becomes a very grave matter. And not only did the CIA work directly, it outsourced a lot of stuff. That is, it went to the British, it went to the Italians, it went to the Australians and perhaps others and said, here's an American person we'd like you to spy on. And then that spying seems to have occurred, and then the information relayed back to Washington. Now, because an American person being spied on like this has to be masked, that is, his or her name has to be blacked out, that it may have come back without that name, but there could be identification markers in the document that make the name clear, or Samantha Power or Susan Rice or somebody can simply go to the intelligence agency and say, I need to have that name unmasked. And they did that. Unmasking is not in itself illegal, but it might become part of something that was illegal, which is if you are not using it for national security purposes, if you're using it for partisan political purposes. So that's what the issue is here. We know that President Obama was well informed about all of this, and we know that through multiple documents, text messages from Strzok and Page, the lovers in the FBI. We know that from documents about a meeting that took place in January 2017, January 5th, after Trump had been elected. So we know Obama was very much part of the mix, but we don't know if he himself was more involved in that. We don't know who coordinated these various agencies that were involved across the U.S. government. We do know that anything that looks like a counterintelligence investigation, which is how many of these FISA warrants were done, those are done for the president. A counterintelligence agency, a counterintelligence investigation is not meant to end up in a court case. So it's not done for the Department of Justice. It's done for the president to conduct national security. So we still don't know. And of course, all this, to go back to the original point that you, Jeff and John were talking about, this bears on Joe Biden because he was in the room in all of this. The worst, but even more important, I think, than the direct involvement like that is that his main claim to fame now is I was part of the Obama administration. So anything that tarnishes its reputation hurts Biden.
But there's something else that you've laid out brilliantly, all these issues, and particularly these three scandals and what they mean to the Republic. But now put a partisan hat on. I work in media, and media is, I'd say, 99.99% to the left. It's just the way it worked out. You're in the academic life where there are still some institutions that are even-handed, but there is also another push, you know, a great push leftward in the academic circles. Both these groups detest Trump for his manner and the fact that he won and defeated Hillary. I understand that. But what do you make of people who consider themselves intelligent, consider themselves analytical and less subject to the emotional upheaval of say the great unwashed that they despise, and they still refuse to see it. What does that tell us?
Well, it's very disturbing, and I do have a number of friends like that, and they really are friends. They're not just people that I they're friends, as we say, in real life.
Yeah.
And many of them are smart and thoughtful, and some of them write me longish emails in this shutdown era, so we can't just sit around and talk and go back and forth. Right. And as I see it, they're just in denial. Now, they still see collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. They just think that all this other stuff is being trumped up by pro-Trump people.
Like it's all out of the forest. Springs fully formed from the flat forehead of Sean Hannity or something like that, right?
Yeah. That's yeah. Likewise, I must say that when Trump himself does things which I think are completely over the top, when he says, you know, he'll shut down Twitter because right. he doesn't like them doing something like putting in a fact check. It's one thing to say, I think it's improper, blah, blah, blah. But to use the bully pulpit of the presidency of the United States to threaten to shut down a media organization is totally improper. And when I post something that says that, people say, well, you know, who are you? You know, you favor Joe Biden or what? I mean, in other words, people can't right. look. They're so invested now in this ideology and divisive politics, it becomes very difficult for them to look at particular issues and say, well, look, this is a very grave matter. So if you and I are old enough, John, you're not, Jeff, to remember that when, as Watergate evolved, most Republicans were still backing Nixon. But at some point, there was enough evidence of real felonies that Nixon was directly involved in obstructing justice that Republicans began to come over to the other side. They began to see it in a different light. And it's really striking that in this kind of an environment, there's been very, very little of that. And it remains, but you can see the effort to smear Barr is because they can't get at John Durham. So when John Durham brings indictments, this is going to be a real test to see if people can see things clearly. People are presumed innocent, of course, but, and I got to tell you, if this is just the little people, not people who ran big agencies and who ran this operation, I, for one, will scream to high heaven. This was not something that started at the bottom somehow. Right. This was done from the top.
If they tell me that Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who belong in a pulp fiction novel, were pulling all the strings here, I will laugh as I watch the Republic crater, because they're just minor players in a larger game.
And, yeah, exactly. Well, you know that great scene in the Maltese Falcon where they're all sitting around over the gunsel who's been knocked out. Elisha Cook Jr. is the actor who plays him, and they're saying, who's gonna take the fall for this? You call it, in the Chicago way, you have a term for it, John.
Yeah, it's called wearing the jacket. Who's going to wear the jacket for this, Peter Strzok? I can smell you from here, but I don't think that that jacket belongs to him alone.
The question is whether the people who are lower down will be in such bad trouble and so clearly about to face convictions that they have to flip on people higher up. It's worth noting that if these trials come in Washington, D.C., I believe Trump got something like 4% of the vote there. This will be like 1950s Mississippi trials of white people for doing something terrible to black people. If you were brought up, the jury just said, hey, we agree with you. You know, right. Walk free, my friend. Right. So you have to be worried about the venue that these things are going to happen. But if lower ranking people are really in deep trouble, then they'll flip on people higher up. And then the question is whether they have documents to back up what they're saying about the bad guys.
Of course, if Biden wins the election, and then is replaced because his brain has turned to banana pudding within, 3 weeks, and we have Kamala Harris or someone, it goes away, does it not?
It absolutely does. I used to say when the Chicago machine really ran things, if you went to a Richard J. Daley and you ask him for your help in carrying Illinois, what do you want? The number one thing he would have wanted was not to appoint the Secretary of the Treasury. The number one thing he would have wanted to appoint was the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, right?
Well, and he did.
Right.
Whether they're Republicans or Democrats.
That is exactly what will happen in a Biden administration. There is no way any of these prosecutions will get to what was really behind all of Obamagate if there's a change of administration. Durham can bring the indictments, but that doesn't mean that they will go forward. There's a lot that DOJ and the FBI and others can do to impede prosecutions.
As we close here, I want to know, Charles, do you think the Washington Post and the New York Times, which present themselves as the great institutions of truth in journalism, will they ever return their Pulitzer Prizes from the Russiagate scandal that never was?
No. And how do we know that? Because they've never returned the Pulitzer Prizes, the Pulitzer Prize from the mid-1930s that was given to New York Times reporter Walter Duranty for repeating Stalin's propaganda in his reporting on the Soviet Union. So to me, the big question here is whether we can ever restore faith in the media and be a warranted faith in the media. And beyond that, whether we can restore faith in America's most important public institutions. There are almost no public institutions, police, whatever it might be, that really have American popular support. The only one big institution, I believe, that does is the U.S. military.
That's a danger.
And in a democracy, we need to have institutions that people trust, and they simply don't.
Charles Lipson, I will watch as Biden, Obama, Clapper, and his crew fiddle while the Republic burns. And in the meantime, thanks for being here.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to talk with you guys. I'm sorry the topic today was so difficult, but it really is important.
It is important, Charles. Thanks for being here. Thanks, buddy. I suppose that we have to thank Dashiell Hammett, too, but I really want to thank Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, and his discussion on his great and important piece, What the Obamagate Scandals Mean and Why They Matter, I would have just added, to the Republic. Tom Bevan used it in Real Clear Politics. It is just brilliant. And apolitical, in a sense. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show on WGN, And me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. Remember, if you like what you hear, if you like this podcast, and you won't hear this kind of stuff anywhere else, then find us on iTunes, subscribe, write us a kick-ass review, find us or subscribe on Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever. We're not paid. We're not paid for this. We just like doing it. We just like talking to you. You know why? Because you matter. I mean it. Thanks for being here for another edition of the Chicago Way.